This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away.
Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Legacy of the Force, Fury, by Aaron Alston. Read for you by Mark Thompson.
Above the planet Kashyyyk, aboard the Millennium Falcon.
The Falcon banked over a vision of hell. Directly below was a roiling surface of blacks and yellows, reds and oranges. Eastward, the carpet of fire gave way to doomed forest. The line between the two zones was an irregular and uncertain one, and even at the distance of a couple of kilometers, Han Solo could see individual trees at the border burst into fire, some of them exploding from the heat. Westward, superheated air rose in a column kilometers in diameter, hauling smoke high into the atmosphere, obscuring the afternoon sun. And it was the smoke column that showed the real danger of the maelstrom. As that column rose, it drew in air from all directions, constantly fanning the fire around it, feeding the voracious beast that burned out of control. It had once been an unbroken vista of soaring rocher trees and other foliage. But a few days earlier, the Star Destroyer Anakin Solo, at the order of Jason Solo, had directed its long-range turbolasers at the surface of Kashyyyk, concentrating fire to cause square-kilometer patches of forest to catch fire. These strikes were intended to punish the Wookiees for harboring Jedi and for dragging their feet before committing their forces to Jason's Galactic Alliance. Punish they had. The fires had grown into firestorms, raging out of control ever since. The Falcon kicked as she glided over a thermal updraft. Han brought her back to smooth, level flight. The communications board crackled with Leia's voice.
Sweep complete. I've planted the last beacon.
Han sent the disc-shaped freighter into a bank and descent toward their rendezvous point, about 2 kilometers outside the fire zone. The Falcon bucked harder as a particularly ferocious thermal caught her, and then she was out over unburned forest. Han checked the comm board, looking for the signal being transmitted by Leia's last beacon, and homed in on it.
Waru, stand by in the winch.
There was an affirmative growl across the intercom. Waru waited at the starboard docking ring, open to Kashyyyk's atmosphere, ready to retrieve Leia. Waru wasn't just any Wookiee. He was Chewbacca's son. A clever son. A good warrior. If things had been very different, if Han's son Jason had not turned out the way he had, perhaps the Falcon could have been Jason someday, with Waru at his side, a continuation of Han's roguish legacy. Instead, Jason had become something dark, something terrible, a self-appointed leader determined to impose rigid control over the galaxy. He had conspired, tortured, betrayed, murdered, all with a confidence in the rightness of his cause that was the match of any madman's. The communications board beeped to indicate that they were close to the beacon source. Han depressed the bow to give himself a better downward look. He heard a thump from the starboard side, followed by a growl of complaint, and grinned again.
Sorry, no more sudden maneuvers, I promise.
The rochers were still tall enough here that the forest floor was a deeply gloomy and dangerous place. There was no clearing to set down in, but Leia was visible. Her white robe starkly contrasted among all the greenery, standing on an upper branch as if loitering on a Coruscant pedwalk, unconcerned about winds or the potentially pesky force of gravity. She waved. Han positioned the Falcon directly above her.
All right, Waru, bring her up.
A moment later, he heard the whirring sound of the winch lowering its line to Leia. The crew of the Millennium Falcon was about to commit an act that, under other circumstances, would have been considered as horrible as Jason's setting of fires, because the two acts were almost the same. A Confederation cruiser in low planetary orbit would soon fire its turbolaser batteries down at the forests, setting portions of them ablaze. But this strike would be surgical, precisely following the kilometers-long line of beacons Leia had planted. Once that line was drawn, The turbo lasers would broaden it toward the east, and the Falcon, other freighters carrying fire-snuffing foam, and Wookiee firefighting teams would control it along its western perimeter. The controlled burn, once extinguished, would leave only char for the advancing wildfire to meet, and that char would be too broad for wind-borne sparks to jump. The fire would end here, and the Falcon and other ships would move on to create fire breaks elsewhere, eventually checking the wildfire everywhere. Finally, its food all consumed, the firestorm, the beast, would die of starvation, leaving behind millions of burned acres and a scarred, smoke-shrouded world. Han heard the winch stop its whir, then, moments later, resume it, bringing Leia up to him. He set the Falcon into a gentle eastward course, sending it away from the firebreak area, and checked to make sure his communications were still set to the Confederation frequency.
Millennium Falcon to Lilibanka. Beacons are in place. You can begin. And number one, if you please. Not number 20.
He heard a chuckle before the voice of the cruiser's male communications officer replied,
"Acknowledge, Falcon, and thanks."
Then there was a new voice, female, pitched low and seductive, from close behind Han.
"Your feelings betray you."
Jolted by adrenaline, Han jerked around to look. Standing in the entrance to the cockpit was a woman. She was robed nearly head to foot in dark garments. Only her face showed, and it was a beautiful face, blue-skinned, cheerful of expression. Her name was Alima Rar, and she had come to kill him. Han drew his blaster. As he did, Alima gestured, a flourish that swept her cloak away from her body, and reached out with her left hand as her right snatched her lightsaber from her belt. Han's pistol, barely clearing its holster, flew from his grip and into hers. Han gaped at her. She should not have been able to do that. Her left arm was useless, had been ruined years earlier, but now it was fine. She tisked at him.
"We are Jedi. We choose not to be shot. We have been shot before. It is not pleasant."
She dropped the blaster. It rang as it hit the deck plates. Han put bravado he didn't feel into his voice.
"So? What are you gonna do, talk me to death?"
"We are going to wait until your piranha beetle of a wife can see. And then we will shove our lightsaber through your heart. She can hold your corpse and cry. Won't that be nice?"
"Not really."
Without taking his gaze off Alima, Han reached forward and disengaged the freighter's inertial compensator and artificial gravity generator. In the same instant, he hit the thrusters and hauled back on the control yoke. He stood the Falcon on her tail and blasted off toward space. With the inertial compensator off, the sudden acceleration crushed him back into his seat. His head swam with unaccustomed dizziness. Alima's expression changed from one of good humor to round-eyed surprise as she fell backward. Han heard her thump against the wall of the cockpit access corridor. She had to have hit where the corridor angled away toward port and stern. He heard his blaster pistol clattering along after her. Then there were more thumps and clatters as Alima and the blaster rolled down the slope the angle wall now constituted. There was also laughter. Peals of Alima's laughter. Waru, his golden-brown fur gleaming orange and red in the glow of fire visible through the docking ring, was just hauling Leia aboard when the Falcon bucked. Her bow suddenly pointed straight toward the smoke-filled sky and accelerated. Waru and Leia were slammed into the aft bulkhead of the corridor just inside the starboard docking ring. Abruptly, the bulkhead was floor, and the acceleration pressed them down like a big invisible hand. Leia unbuckled herself from the winch harness and drew in a breath to shout at Han. Then she heard it, laughter echoing off the Falcon's bulkheads and floor plates. Waru stood.
"Alima Rar, she's aboard."
Leia drew on the Force to augment her physical strength. She stood shakily, took her lightsaber in hand, and ignited it. "Let's go." Stiff-legged, she marched the several meters down the boarding ring corridor. She reached the hatchway leading to the freighter's main corridor, the curved passageway that offered access to all the Falcon's compartments. The freight lift was probably where Alima was now, but Leia couldn't be sure of that either. The laughter had ceased, and Leia could not find Alima in the Force. Leia glanced over her shoulder at Waru.
"Get to the cockpit. That's where Alima is going to end up. Protect Han. Watch out for poison darts."
Waru groaned in assent. He moved past Leia, crouched, and leapt across the main corridor. Leia had to find Alima, but that wouldn't be too difficult, for the mad Twi'lek's merry laughter reached her again, distinctly from the direction of the Falcon's stern. Lightsaber lit, she carefully moved toward Alima. Ahead to the left, upside down to her current position, was the freighter's engineering station, its consoles permitting the monitoring of every system aboard ship. Ahead to the right, the curved wall gave way to the broad opening leading into the engineering bay, with its access to the freight lift, hyperdrive, sublight engines, and other critical systems. From that direction, there was the sound of a lightsaber humming, but it was a constant tone, a weapon being held still, neither advancing nor maneuvering. Leia reached out through the Force, looking again for her quarry. She detected first Waru, then Han, then Waru again. Again? She opened her mouth to call a question over her comlink, but the lightsaber ahead of her began snapping and hissing as it contacted a metal surface. Leia swore under her breath and charged forward. As she rounded the corner into the engineering bay, she spotted her quarry. On the far side of the freight lift, Alima Rar stood beside the broad circular housing of the hyperdrive. She held her lightsaber in two good steady hands as she drove its point deep into the housing, sending up sparks that illuminated the bay brilliantly. She looked over as Leia entered.
Princess, come help us destroy the hyperdrive. Then together we can cut the engines to pieces.
Wary, Leia advanced.
I'll cut you to pieces first. That will show me how to do it. You first.
Alima's words were cut off as the Falcon suddenly spun axially, dropping the floor from beneath her feet and sending her crashing into the ceiling, throwing Leia shoulder first into the starboard bulkhead. The Falcon's spin pinned Leia against the corridor for long moments. She drew on the Force to help her push away from it, resisting centrifugal effect, but it took all her concentration. That, and the need to keep an eye on Alima, and an ear on all the items of cargo, machinery, personal gear, and for all she knew, personnel ricocheting off bulkheads all over the ship. Alima was not as encumbered by the Falcon's movements. The spin had pinned her for a moment to the ceiling, but now she rose as if its gravity were proper and steady. She stood on two good feet, despite the fact Leia knew she'd lost half of one foot. Her features were as youthful and unblemished as when Leia had first met her 15 standard years before. Leia forced herself to keep her voice low and calm.
Finally invested in some prosthetics, did you? Nothing so crude. We are simply ageless and eternal now, as we have always deserved to be.
Alima lifted her lightsaber in a traditional salute, a come-fight-me gesture. The Falcon stood on her tail again. Leia caught off guard, hurtled toward the rear of the engineering bay, right past Alima, who didn't budge. Leia spun her lightsaber in a defensive arc, an attempt to block the blow she knew must come. But it didn't. Alima merely danced aside. Leia crashed into the stern bulkhead, an impact that sent waves of shock through her back muscles, shoulder blades, spine. For a brief second, she was helpless, bent with pain. But Alima didn't whip out her blowgun to send a dart her way. She didn't even essay a lightning-quick leap followed by a maiming slash with her weapon. She advanced slowly, walking carefully down the ceiling toward Leia. There was a dull rattling noise, and Waru, spinning like a child's toy, hurtled down at Leia from the main corridor. Leia twisted aside and exerted herself upward through the Force, slowing Waru's fall. The Wookiee crashed into the bulkhead beside her, but softly, not hard enough to impair a being of his size and strength. Alima's smile broadened. In a movement that was curiously clumsy and unpracticed, she raised her lightsaber and charged to swing it down at Waru. Leia raised her own blade, catching Alima's seemingly unpracticed attack. Their blades met, sizzled, sparked. Waru rolled away from the two of them and sat up, swinging his bowcaster off his back and aiming it at Alima. The weapon, built tough to Wookiee standards, did not seem to be damaged. No! Leia lashed out with her foot as Waru fired. She connected first, kicking Alima backward, and angled her own lightsaber to catch the bowcaster bolt. It sizzled out of existence against the blade. Puzzled, Waru offered an offended growl. He rose to his feet and hastily reckoned his bowcaster. Leia got her feet under her and leapt toward Alima, positioning herself between the Twi'lek and the Wookiee. She caught Alima's next strike, this one as suitably swift and ferocious as any Jedi's, before it could sever her right arm. But she did not press her attack. Waru, don't shoot! There's something wrong! Trust me! Waru aimed, but did not fire. Leia strained against Alima's blade, panting from pain and exertion. Alima tried to disengage and strike, but Leia simply followed her, step for step, staying close, fighting purely defensively. Alima struck a second time, and a third, all shots toward one of Leia's limbs, but Leia blocked two of the blows, dodged the third. Alima's smile did not fade, but after another moment, her strength seemed to. She sagged back as Leia continued to push.
Fine.
Her tone was light, but there was a forced, brittle quality to it.
We will meet later.
She leapt up and backward, landing on the main corridor wall above, her motion so light and graceful that it seemed she could not possibly be affected by the Falcon's constant upward acceleration. Then she turned and ran toward the hatchways to the circuitry bay and crew quarters. Leia and Waru leapt after her, an effort for both Jedi and Wookiee. But though Alima had been out of sight for only a few moments, though she could not have made it as far as either hatchway, she was gone.
Chief of State's briefing office, Coruscant.
The advisor's voice was like the droning of insects, and Darth Kytus knew what to do about insects. Ignore them, or step on them. But in this case, he couldn't afford to ignore the drone. The advisor, whatever her failings as a speaker, was providing him with critical data. Nor could he raise a boot to crush the source of the drone. Not with Admiral Cha Nyathol, his partner in the coalition government, running Coruscant in the Galactic Alliance, sitting on the other side of the table. Not with aides hovering and holocam recorders running. To make matters worse, the advisor would soon wrap up, and inevitably she would address him by the name he so disliked. The name he had been born with. The name he would soon abandon. And then he would once again feel and have to resist the urge to crush her. She did it. The blue-skinned Amwati female looked up from her data pad.
In conclusion, Colonel Solo.
Kytus gestured to interrupt her. In conclusion, the withdrawal of the entire Hapen fleet from Alliance forces removes at least 20% of our naval strength and puts us into a game of withdrawal and entrenchment if we're to keep the Confederation from overrunning us. And the treachery of the Jedi in abandoning us at Kuat is further causing a loss of hope among the segments of the population who believe that their involvement means something.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. That will be all. She rose, saluted, and left silently, her posture stiff. Nyathol addressed the other aides present.
We are done here, thank you.
When the office door whooshed closed behind the last of them, Kytus turned to Nyathol. The Mon Calamari, her white admiral's uniform almost gleaming, regarding him.
You do not look well.
She was suggesting he was not fit for duty. And she was almost right. Kytus hurt everywhere. Mere days before, he had waged the most ferocious, most terrible lightsaber duel of his life. In a secret chamber aboard his Star Destroyer, the Anakin Solo, he had been torturing Ben Skywalker to harden the young man's spirit, to better prepare Ben for life as a Sith. But he had been caught by Ben's father, Luke Skywalker. That fight had gone on for what it felt like forever. It had been brutal, with the advantage being held first by Luke, then by Kytus. At the end, Kytus had lost a position of advantage. Luke had slipped free of the poison-injecting torture vines with which Kytus had been strangling him, when Ben had driven a vibroblade deep into Kytus's back, punching clean through a shoulder blade, nearly reaching his heart. That had ended the fight. Kytus should have been killed immediately. For reasons he did not understand, Luke and Ben had spared his life and departed. It was a mistake that would cost Luke. Bearing dozens of minor and major wounds, including the vibroblade puncture, a lightsaber-scored kidney, and a fierce scalp wound, Kytus had been treated and resumed command of the Anakin Solo, only to experience more injury. Emotional injury, this time. In Kashyyyk space, his 5th Fleet had been surrounded by Confederation forces. Late arriving Hapen forces could have rescued him, but the Hapen Queen Mother, Tenel Ka, his comrade and lover, had betrayed him. Swayed by the treacherous persuasion of Kaidus' own parents, Han and Leia Solo, she had demanded a price for her continued military support of the Alliance, and that price had been his surrender. Of course he had refused, and of course he had battered his way out of the encirclement, leading the remnants of the Fifth Fleet back to the safety of Coruscant. So when Niathal said he did not look well, she was correct. He keenly felt his worst injury. Not the vibroblade wound, not the scalp tear, not the kidney damage. All three were healing. All three were the kind of pain that strengthened him. It was the wound to his heart that plagued him. Tenel Ka had turned on him. Tenel Ka, the love of his life, the mother of his daughter Alana, had forsaken him. Niathal's severe expression didn't waver. She was thinking he could fix this mess by resigning. He gave her a tight smile. Thank you for your concern, but I'm recovering quickly, and I have a plan. We'll need to follow the recommended protocol of a fighting retreat for the next few days, at which time the Hapens will come back into the war on our side. Our job today is to figure out how to best employ them when they return to the battlefield. Since the Confederation thinks they are staying on the fence, we can utilize the Hapens for one devastating surprise attack. We need to decide where that attack will take place. Niathal turned to the next matter on her agenda.
Belindi Kalenda at Intelligence reports that Dr. Sayar has been pulled off the Centerpoint Station project. Sayar reported that he had come under suspicion of being a GA spy.
Which of course he is. What's his new posting, and can he get us any useful information from there? Niathal shook her head in the slow, somber way of the Mon Cals.
Kalenda ordered him out. He's already back on Coruscant.
Kaidus resisted the urge to break something. She's an idiot, and Sayah is an idiot. He could have stayed, weathered whatever investigation they brought against him, and begun feeding us information again. What's next?
Bima Sahari and some of her allied worlds in the Hala Sector just announced they were defecting to the Confederation.
Kaidus shook his head dismissively. Not a significant loss.
No, but it's more unsettling as the possible first sign of a trend. Intelligence has detected more communications traffic between Corellia and the Imperial Remnant and between Corellia and the worlds of the corporate sector, which may be nothing more than an increased recruitment effort by the Confederation. Or it may have been initiated by the other parties, a prelude to negotiations and more defections.
Also irrelevant. Kaidus felt a flash of irritation. Anything else?
No.
Excellent.
Sanctuary Moon of Endor. Abandoned Imperial Outpost.
Years earlier, before Jason Solo had been born, before, in fact, Luke and Leia knew they were siblings, before Leia had confessed even to herself that she was in love with Han, Yoda had told Luke that electrical shocks applied at different intensities and at irregular but frequent intervals would prevent a Jedi from concentrating, from channeling the Force. They could render a Jedi helpless. But Yoda had never told Luke that emotional shocks could do the same thing. They could. And just as no amount of self-control would allow a Jedi to ignore the effects of electrical shocks on his body, neither could self-control keep Luke safely out of his memories. Every few moments, a memory, freshly applied like a current-bearing wire on his skin, would yank him out of the here and now and propel him into the recent past. Boarding the Anakin Solo, finding Jason torturing Luke's only child, his son Ben. The duel that followed, Luke against the nephew he'd once loved, the nephew who now commanded master-level abilities in the Force, though he had not been and never would be elevated to the rank of Jedi Master. And no pain Luke suffered in that fight was equal to Ben demanding the right to finish Jason. That demand had brought Luke to where he was now sitting, cross-legged on the floor of an upper-story room of an abandoned Imperial outpost, staring through a wide transparent steel viewport at a lush Endor forest he was barely aware of. His body healing, but his spirit sick and injured even after all these days. A translucent white rectangle, tall and very thin, appeared on the viewport ahead of Luke. It rapidly broadened, revealing itself as the reflection of a door opening in the wall behind him. Jedi Master Kip Duren stood in the doorway, his brown robes rumpled, his long, graying brown hair sweaty and unkempt. His expression, normally one of mild amusement, layered over what was usually interpreted as a trace of cockiness, was now more somber, neutrality concealing concern. "Grandmaster?" "Come in." Luke did not turn to face Kip. Kip moved in and the door shut behind him. "Just a routine report. The stealth X's are spread by wing pairs across a broad area, under camouflage netting. Many of the pilots found useful landing spots in the areas where debris from the second Death Star came down and created burn zones. The younglings are packed into two large chambers, acting as dormitories on this outpost, but a reconnaissance team of Jedi Knights has found a cavern system not too far away that will provide ample space for a training facility and some defense against orbital sensors." "Good. Anything else?" "There's been some question about our next action against Jason." "Ah, yes." Luke turned to look out the viewport again. "I don't know. Why don't you arrange that?" There was a long silence. Then, "Yes, Grandmaster." The rectangle of light appeared. Kip's reflection moved into it, and it closed again, leaving Luke in silence and peace, and confronted by the memory of Jason, bloodied and battered, almost beyond recognition, crawling away from him, Ben's vibroblade lodged in his back. Ben's face appeared before him, mouthing the words, "This kill is mine." Luke shivered.
"Kashyyyk, Maytel Base, hangar housing the Millennium Falcon."
There were still bright spots before Han's eyes, right at the center of his focus, from the brilliance of a turboblast he had almost flown into. He had to scan, traverse his line of sight in order to work around them. Directly before him was an old sabacc table with a rusty rim and a grime-spotted felt surface. A brandy bottle and a set of tumblers rested upon it. Beyond was the Millennium Falcon, her boarding ramp down, with Wookiee utility vehicles and Confederation spacecraft parked beside her. Descending the Falcon's boarding ramp was their daughter, Jaina. As she descended, she wiped her hands on an oily blue rag, then noticed Han watching.
"Dad, all fixed."
"You're kidding."
Jaina shook her head, then took a chair at his table. "Alima's attack did some damage, but she didn't have much time to root around in the hyperdrive before Mom interrupted her. I replaced a couple of parts, and it checks out in the green. You want to take her up and do a practice run or two, I expect."
"I expect. Thanks." He gave Leia a sidelong look. "I'm getting more obsolete every day. I don't even have to patch up the Falcon's battle damage anymore."
Leia gave him a smile tinged with malice. "You'll never be obsolete as long as some people prefer old-fashioned tactics and parts."
"It's such a shame you can't spank a Jedi."
There was a clattering of heels, and Han looked up to see Jagged Fell and Zek coming down the boarding ramp. Fell, son of one of the Empire's most celebrated fighter pilots and nephew of one of the New Republics, was a well-muscled man of middle height, his hair, neatly trimmed beard and mustache black, a white lock at his hairline marking an old scalp wound. He wore a black flight suit. On a dark night, he would look like a face and hands floating in the air. Zek, Jaina's Jedi partner, was unusually tall, his long dark hair currently braided. Like Leia, he was dressed in ordinary Jedi robes. Jag held a blaster pistol, his finger not in the trigger housing, and as he neared Han, he reversed it, offering it butt first. "Found it." Han set down his drink. He took the pistol, twirled it experimentally, and holstered it.
"Thanks."
"So," Leia fixed the three newcomers with a quick, serious look. "Anything? Any sign of Alima?" Jag, still standing, shook his head. "None." His voice was thoughtful. "Extra none." Leia frowned, puzzled. What does that mean?
Zek cocked a thumb over his shoulder toward the Falcon. Alima left behind no fingerprints, no threads from her robes. There weren't any skin cells on any of the bulkheads you said she hit. Han scowled.
She had to have left fingerprints on my blaster. She pulled it to her with the Force. Caught it in her hand.
Her left hand, you said?
Jag's voice was thoughtful.
Yeah?
She has to have finally accepted prosthetics,
Jag considered.
Though the custom is to obtain prosthetics identical to your original limbs, down to every mole and fingerprint whorl, that's not because of some unbreakable law of cybernetics. She could have gotten replacements without identifying features.
Leia shook her head, clearly unhappy.
So there's nothing to prove Alima was ever there.
Han snorted.
Nothing but a damaged and repaired hyperdrive.
Which still isn't proof. Zek gave Leia an apologetic shrug. We really don't have any forensic means to distinguish between cuts of different lightsabers. But why do you need proof? We believe you.
Because I'm not sure I believe myself at this point. I couldn't even feel her in the Force. Only Lumpy, Waru.
Leia looked around guilty, caught in the act of using a childhood nickname abandoned by its owner. Fortunately, Waru was not in the hangar.
I don't even know how she escaped.
I have an idea. Jaina frowned, thoughtful. But it's pretty weird. A couple of years back, when Jason and Ben went to Brishasayo's asteroid, Ben had a fight with an evil Mara phantom.
Han and Leia exchanged a glance. Han shrugged.
You're saying we just fought a phantom?
A phantom wouldn't leave fingerprints, Dad. A phantom could vanish instantly from a sealed freighter.
Han shook his head.
But Brishasayo's dead. Her mother Lumaya is dead.
Right, Dad. But we're getting reports that Alima is now piloting a craft that resembles an ancient Sith meditation sphere.
Leia considered.
So why was I seeing Alima but feeling Waru?
Her daughter shrugged.
I don't know, but I suspect that your instinct not to cut her down was a very good one.
She's going to use this technique again, and she'll get better with practice,
Jag said.
So our need to find her is more pressing than ever, especially in light of the fact that she's the number one suspect in the murder of Mara Jade Skywalker. We don't want the Grand Master to devote more and more resources to hunting her down, not with the Civil War becoming bloodier, more complicated. The Jedi are needed elsewhere.
Han nodded.
So you'll need Colonel Solo's shuttle, the one he used on the trip to that asteroid.
Jag looked dubious.
Brishasayo or Lumaya would never let the shuttle leave with the correct plot of the asteroid's location.
Han grinned.
Just because you're young doesn't mean you have to be stupid, Jag. Sure, she'd have fixed the coordinates in the shuttle's memory, but go deeper into the shuttle's records. Amount of fuel burn to the millimeter per burn. Duration in hyperspace for each jump. Amount of time after leaving hyperspace until the shuttle hypercom receives traffic to the millisecond compared with when that traffic was originally dispatched.
Jag considered and whistled again.
We'd need some high-end computing and decryption power to process that kind of data.
We can get it, Sonny. Talon Card or Booster Tarek will give it to us, if no one else. But first we'll have to get aboard.
Han tried to prevent himself from grimacing, but couldn't. Not quite.
Aboard the Anakin Solo. Get a crack at that Colonel's shuttle. Planning session?
Jag nodded.
A couple of hours. You can calm around and get that computer time for us. We all need some downtime for our brains. Zek and Jaina wanted to get in some lightsaber training for when we do run Alima down.
Sanctuary Moon of Endor, Jedi Outpost.
The flat top of the outpost had once been a landing pad for the shuttles and TIE fighters. And now, some 40 standard years later, relics of that era still littered the pad. A discarded wheel from a shuttle's landing gear, a rusty rolling cart that had once held tools, a scattering of corroded nuts and bolts that neither wind nor time had managed to scour from the surface. They met there, Jedi Masters in exile. Luke Skywalker, Kyle Katarn, the Mon Cal healer Silgal, Kip Duran, Corran Horn, the fierce reptilian Saba Sebatine, and Octa Ramus of Chandrilla. Octa, trained by Cam and Tion Solasar, both still recovering from their near-fatal wounds at the hands of Jason Solo's soldiers, was more subdued than the rest, her stillness in the Force clearly a consequence of rigid self-control rather than inner peace. Kip caught Luke's attention.
I have something to bounce off you.
With a flick of his wrist and an exertion through the Force, he sent the ancient wheel soaring through the air toward Luke. Luke somersaulted to the right, and the wheel flew harmlessly over him. He came to his feet, igniting his lightsaber, as the wheel dropped to the landing pad surface and rolled nearly to the far edge of the roof before toppling and lying still.
Funny.
He advanced toward Kip in mock menace.
Is this every master for himself?
Kip shrugged and ignited his own lightsaber.
Might as well.
Luke heard snap hisses, and the other masters lit their weapons. This friendly exercise would be horribly dangerous to anyone but a Jedi Master, but all of those present were so in tune with the Force and one another that the odds of a mishap were, as usual, almost nil. Luke charged Kip, but then, well outside lightsaber strike range, skidded to an abrupt halt. Kip's face had just enough time to register suspicion before Luke exerted himself through the Force, reaching upward to tree limbs that had grown out over the outpost. He yanked downward. A broad branch slapped down atop Kip, bearing him to the landing pad surface and sending leaves swirling out all over the roof. Kip laughed and rolled free, coming up to his feet.
No fair.
Tactical superiority is never fair. I mean getting leaves and bugs in my hair.
Luke felt the approach of Silgol from behind. He leapt up and backward, inverting as he flew, and blocked the Mon Cal Master's strike with his blade in passing. He landed behind her. A few meters away, Saba Sebatine and Corrin Horn dueled, each adopting a traditional, formalized lightsaber posture. Saba using a lightsaber in each hand. Corrin, with his own weapon adjusted to its second setting, its blade now 3 meters in length, and a brilliant purple instead of its usual silver. Octa Ramus, who had supplied Saba with her second weapon, was content to stand off to one side, using the Force to hurl stones, plucked from the ground far below, through the tumult of practicing masters. Kyle Katarn stood near her, watching all the others, practicing ritualized sword forms and waiting for an opponent to come open. Kip advanced against Luke again, striking at Luke's ankles, while Silgol engaged the Grandmaster's blade. Luke danced over the low strike and put a foot into Silgol's torso, more of a push than a kick, before landing again. The Mon Cal staggered back a few steps, offering a nod of appreciation. Kip threw a succession of fast blows at Luke's shoulders, occupying him while Silgol recovered.
Actually, it's a plan for a mission against Jason. A capture or neutralize, he said, his lightsaber flashing at Luke.
Neutralize, Luke frowned, meaning kill. Kip nodded, not repentant.
This isn't a mission of assassination, Luke. But if the capture isn't clean, if the choice is to run away and leave him in charge of the Alliance, or finish him then and there...
Yeah. Luke felt Silgol's approach behind him. He bent over backward, his lightsaber hand coming down on the landing pad surface to hold his upper body clear of it, and Silgol's lightsaber passed through where his waist would have been. Luke instantly straightened, catching her hilt with his free hand, and stepped away, her lightsaber now in his grip. He twirled one blade at each master.
Go on.
Kip looked dubiously at Luke's twin weapons and fell into a defensive posture.
The team will consist of one or two masters, three or four Jedi Knights, and a native guide. They'll approach the Senate building through the Undercity.
As Luke neared and began throwing probing attacks in quick succession, Kip deflected them close to his body with equal speed and minimal movement.
When Jason enters or leaves the building, they spring the trap. Gomagassin Shocknet says the first wave, the Jedi making their direct assault immediately afterward. We have a shuttle or enclosed vehicle land for a quick extraction. But the trick is, it's an empty droid vehicle. Our group, with Jason, the captive, actually re-enters the Undercity through a groundside maintenance access hatch, modified to serve as an exit. While the shuttle makes its escape run and draws off pursuit, our group goes back the way it came, to the true departure point.
Who's the team leader?
Kip shrugged.
Not determined yet.
Corrin's and Kyle's voices rose simultaneously.
Me! Me!
Me.
Luke switched off Silgall's lightsaber and tossed it over his shoulder. He heard it slap down into a big webbed hand. What about your native guy? Someone to get you through the Undercity, I'm guessing. Do you trust him? Kip nodded.
Not as far as I can throw her.
That was Corrin, his voice punctuated by zaps as Saba advanced on him, trying to bat his longer blade aside. Kip made a sour face.
Horn, you can throw anybody any distance. With the Force, anyway. This calls your judgment into question.
Her? Luke switched off his lightsaber. Maybe I should meet her. Kip deactivated his own weapon. She's one level down. I can have her come up if you want to meet her now.
Sure.
Kip spoke into a comlink. The other masters left off their exercise, extinguished their lightsabers, and gathered around. A section of roof slid aside, and a metal plate rose to occupy that space, lift style. On it stood a teenage girl in Jedi robes. She was red-headed, and she nervously twirled one lock of hair in her fingers. At Kip's gesture, she approached. Luke recognized her and frowned.
I know you. Saha, from the temple.
She came to a stop in front of him and nodded.
Yes, Grandmaster.
He tried to remember her record with the Jedi Order. She hadn't been with them long, an orphan since childhood, he recalled. She'd been sponsored to the Order by... Jason.
Ah. There would seem to be some question as to your reliability.
Saha nodded, agitation making her motion fast, jerky.
Some people don't trust me.
Why?
Because I'm a traitor to the Jedi Order.
Corrin Horn's eyebrows rose. He looked faintly impressed.
Well, I'll give her points for honesty.
Luke ignored him.
Perhaps you'd better explain that.
I was little when the Yuuzhan Vong came to Coruscant, when the Vong forming happened. Most of my family died. I don't remember them except my father. We lived in the Undercity, so deep and out of touch that the Yuuzhan Vong had been driven off-world for months before I even learned about it. My father was dead by then, stung by a Yuuzhan Vong insect he didn't see in time. I stayed there, with the other refugees and crazies and rejects, because they were the only people I knew. But I met Jason. He'd come down from time to time. Sometimes his visits were years apart, to visit his friend, the World Brain. My home was close to the World Brain's lair. I thought it was a horrible, evil thing. But Jason told me how it was just acting according to its nature, that what it looked like had nothing to do with what it was inside. Jason figured out I was Force-sensitive and arranged for me to become an apprentice to the Order, even though I was old for an apprentice.
I know what it's like to be old for an apprentice. Luke's voice was gentle, but now he let an edge creep into it.
So how did you betray the Order?
I did things for Jason. Kept him updated on goings-on in the temple.
She took a deep breath before continuing.
When your son disappeared, I was the one who helped him get out of the temple without being seen.
Luke stared at her for a long moment.
At Jason's order?
Yes.
Luke stared at her. He tried to remain impassive, but she apparently saw something in his expression and took an involuntary half-step backward. Luke didn't bother trying to keep anger from his voice. How were you found out?
She wasn't. She came forward.
Silgall put a comforting hand on Saha's shoulder.
When we received word about the massacre on Ossus...
Saha blinked, and tears came.
I don't know how he could do that. Sending a crazy man to bargain with younglings' lives? To torture Camp Solasar and Tion and all those others?
Her tears flowed freely now, but she ignored them.
I betrayed the Order, but not like that. I'm not going to do that.
You're no Jedi.
Corrin's voice was harsh.
Your emotions are all over the map. Even an apprentice knows that. So we can't trust you as a Jedi. We can't trust you to be a calm, collected operative. And now you've left the most dangerous man in the galaxy disappointed in you.
He gestured at Luke.
Plus, you volunteered to go on a mission to capture the second most dangerous man, when all you had to do to retain everyone's trust was keep your mouth shut.
Saha glared at him.
Trust isn't worth anything when it's built on lies. Maybe I'm the stupidest girl you've ever met, but even I can figure that out.
No one answered her immediately. Even Corin's expression was more evaluative than angry. And Luke knew, both from experience and from what he felt through the Force, that Corin had been goading the girl professionally, his own display of emotion simulated. Finally, Silgal broke the silence.
In fairness, after the Order broke ranks with Jason and the Alliance at Kuat, when the Guard moved against the temple to seize it, Sahar helped destroy the computers. She carried out a complete set of records and led two Jedi Knights to safety through the Undercity.
Luke cleared his throat to catch Sahar's attention. You can stay in the Order, without going on this mission. A brief, uncertain smile flashed across Sahar's lips.
I can?
You can. You should. Jason is extraordinarily dangerous. If he sees you, he might devote only a single negligent attack to you. Such an attack would distract a Jedi Master, hurt a Jedi Knight, and kill you. She swallowed.
Does anyone in the Order know the Undercity approaches to Jason's offices?
Zek, perhaps. She shook her head.
He doesn't know it since the Vong forming, since the rebuilding after the war. I'd better stay with the mission.
And keep your head down.
And keep my head down.
Luke took a long breath, then looked around. Will you all excuse me? Kip, please escort Sahar downstairs, then return to me in a few minutes. They all bowed, and grave-faced withdrew, descending via the lift plate by which Sahar had arrived. Alone, Luke stood away from the ill-balanced tool rack, closing his eyes, immersing himself in the Force, looking for guidance. The Force was silent. It seemed like forever since it had shown him any guidance about the bigger picture. All it offered him these days was guidance for immediate problems, the here and now. It had been that way since... for how long? Since Mara's death, at least. It could have begun before then. Perhaps he could no longer read the Force. Perhaps it chose not to speak to him anymore. And if that was true, he could not remain the Grand Master of the Order. He would lead the Jedi into ruin. Grand Master? Luke opened his eyes. Kip stood before him. Luke neither heard nor felt him coming. Luke forced his thoughts back to the present. You've been putting together the plan for this mission. Yes. Why is there some doubt as to who's going to lead it? Kip hesitated a moment. Masters Horn and Katarn have volunteered. I am also willing to lead it. But I haven't assigned a mission leader yet, because I think you should lead it. Absolutely not, Luke said. Please, hear me out. There's worry in the Order. It comes from not knowing where we're going. The Jedi need you to show them. They need you to lead. A mission like this shows them your goals, your heart. If I lead this mission, Luke thought, I will strike at Jason with hatred. One of us will die, and Ben will follow our mutual example and be lost to the dark side. Luke did not need the Force to show him the future to know that this was true. He thought about it a long moment. Here's my decision. Master Katarn will lead this mission. Kip's face fell. Yes, Grand Master.
Hapes, Galactic Alliance Shuttle, approaching the palace of the Queen Mother.
The engineering officer aboard the Galactic Alliance Shuttle had a 5-day growth of whiskers, a patch over his right eye, with the edges of a blaster scar peeking from beneath its edges at forehead and cheek, and a dress uniform whose tunic was pulled out from the waistband. Under the synth skin appliances on his cheeks, under the pasted-on whiskers and cosmetic eye patch, was Darth Kitus. He sat quietly in the co-pilot's seat of the cockpit, monitoring vehicle system diagnostics, assisting the pilot with various checklists and responding in monosyllables to attempts at conversation. He did perk up, though, not visibly to the pilot, when the shuttle, in its final descent into Hapen airspace, came within sight of the cliffside approach to the palace of the Queen Mother. His visible eye was alert, taking in every detail as the shuttle entered the visitor's hangar of the palace. Following space traffic controller directions, the pilot immediately turned to starboard. Kaidus calculated numbers of Haven shuttles, crescent moon-shaped Maytil fighters, airspeeders, speeder bikes. He noted with satisfaction the continued presence of a Stealth X starfighter, the one flown here by Tahiri. It was still awaiting transport back to the Jedi or the Galactic Alliance, doubtless still waiting for Hape's own allegiance to be resolved before it could be moved. Kaidus' shuttle, on repulsor lifts, cruised past many civilian workers and military personnel, the majority of them women. Then, directed by flickering landing lights, the shuttle maneuvered into a bay and set down. The pilot, a white-furred Bothan male, turned to face Kaidus.
"Why don't you inform your passengers they may..."
Then he stopped, scrutinizing Kaidus' solemn, impassive expression and slovenly dress. His snout twitched.
"Never mind. I'll do that."
He rose and squeezed past Kaidus into the main cabin. Kaidus half-listened through the partially shut cockpit door as the pilot addressed the diplomat and aides who constituted all the passengers the pilot knew about.
"Are cleared to leave the shuttle, but they do not confirm a meeting with the Queen Mother. Be in for quite a wait."
Most of Kaidus's concentration was elsewhere, as he searched in the Force for the distinctive trace of his child. This was risky. Opening himself up to the Force tended to make him easier to detect by Jedi. If Tenel Ka, the only other Jedi-trained individual he knew to be in the region, detected him, things would go badly. Almost immediately, he found Alana. A bright, joyous flare in the Force, not far away as the Hawkbat flew. But between the two of them were countless warriors and security measures. Kaidus heard the main cabin's exterior hatch open, heard the passengers descend the boarding ramp, heard the hatch close again. Through the forward viewport, he watched as the diplomatic party moved away from the shuttle. It was greeted and scanned by a half-squadron of Haven security officers. As the knot of them moved toward waiting turbolifts, he could feel no one aboard. No one but himself, the pilot, and one other. Finally, the pilot came forward again. Kaidus took out a small, expensive holdout blaster. As the Bothan's eyes began to widen, Kaidus shot him in the chest. The blaster was set to stun. The pilot's eyes rolled up in his head and he collapsed. Kaidus went aft into the cargo area and spent a few moments unloading baggage cases from atop a large polymer crate. He punched a number into the crate's security pad. The light beside it changed from red to green, and he lifted the lid. Inside, a solemn-faced little red-headed girl looked up at him. Her voice was high and piping, but unafraid.
"Your beard is nasty."
"Isn't it?" He stooped to lift her out of the case. She seemed in good spirits, despite the hours she'd had to remain lying down. But the ready supply of snacks and availability of a game-laden datapad had doubtless helped. "Were you afraid, Tika?"
"No, I really have to go to the refresher. Really, really."
Kaidus gestured forward to the narrow door just on his side of the entry to the main compartment. "Go ahead, and when you're done, we're going to put you in a new dress and do your hair, then have some fun."
"Good. I want to play."
She dashed to the refresher.
"You will."
Elsewhere in the palace, levels above and many meters away from the visitor's hangar, Queen Mother Tenel Ka stared into a mirror, seeing the worry in the gray eyes of her reflection. A delicate chime sounded. Tenel Ka said, "Enter," freeing the security measures on the door. It slid to one side, admitting her father, Prince Isolder. He bent over Tenel Ka to kiss the top of her head.
"You seem to be anxious for privacy. As a good parent, of course, I can't accede to your wishes."
She smiled, despite her mood.
"You're still a pirate at heart. Disobedient, conceited, cocksure."
"A lovely compliment. Thank you."
He moved to settle on a scarlet divan.
"What has you so upset?"
She shrugged.
"I think it's this meeting with the GA representatives. I can't seem to settle on the right amount of time to keep them waiting."
In the mirror, she saw her father nod.
"You want to see them when they are at their most desperate, when they are most likely to agree to your demands to have Colonel Solo removed from power."
"Yes."
"And you're weighing that against the lives being lost every day in the war."
"Yes."
Isolder considered. Tenelka watched him. Finally, he met her gaze again.
You've already made your demand of them at Kuat.
I did.
Send these diplomats home. Today. Seeing them would only give them the opportunity to argue with you. Seeing them later gives them the hope that they can argue with you then. Ejecting them from Hapen's space tells them that there will be no negotiation. That, more than anything, will increase their sense of desperation.
She cocked her head, considering.
You're right.
Another series of chiming musical notes filled the air. This was not a door signal, but a communication, indicating that the security alert level within the palace had just eased up another notch. She pressed a button on the edge of her vanity table.
Lady Eros?
A moment later, her chamberlain entered through the same doorway Isolder had used.
Queen Mother? Why the last alert change? I will find out, Queen Mother.
Eros bowed and withdrew. Isolder smiled, amused.
You are nervous today.
Yes, I am. So I have to hope something is actually going wrong. I don't want to pick up the reputation of being unwell.
Eros re-entered the chamber.
It was an automated elevation of the alert status, Queen Mother. When enough random events occur that the security computers register them, the programs do what is known, I believe, as raising flags, simply indicating...
Tenelka gestured to cut off her explanation.
What random events? Small static interruptions and security holocam feeds, but none has lasted more than a few seconds. Security says that during intrusions, holocam interruptions last for much longer periods, a minimum of half a minute or a minute. They've checked to be sure that the holocam views, once they resume, are current images, not recordings. Yes, Queen Mother.
Eros's voice was endlessly, unnecessarily patient. Tenelka frowned, not convinced, and opened herself to the Force. First she sought out Alana, and found her, nearby, calm, sleeping. Then she broadened her perceptions, looking for anything amiss. She felt it, almost immediately. A short, distinct pulse in the Force. Her eyes snapped open.
There is a Force user in the palace!
She punched additional buttons on the keypad of her vanity, and her own image in the mirror suddenly faded, to be replaced by an overhead view of a child's playroom. She breathed a sigh of relief. Alana was there, undisturbed, sitting at her modeling table, head down as she worked intently at the controls. Her hair spilled around her face, obscuring it. The Bantha that had been her newest creation now had four giant bulbous feet. Then Tenelka frowned. A moment earlier, an instant earlier, Alana had been asleep. She keyed in another location, and the view changed to that of the door outside her daughter's play chamber. It was closed, sealed, innocuous. Except for the fact that the two guards who should have been on duty there were missing. Coldness, hard as an ancient ice comet, froze her stomach. Tenelka stood fast enough to hurl her chair backward. It thumped down on the carpeted floor. She spun on Eros.
Alert security! Intruders in the palace! They're making an attempt on Alana!
From beneath her robes, suited to an afternoon's lounging beside an artificial waterfall, she pulled her lightsaber and dashed past Eros, her father behind her. Security chimes were sounding as the two of them reached the main corridor, accessing the secondary royal quarters. Rightward, it led toward Alana's playroom. Leftward, it led to the security stations that in turn gave way to less secure areas. Security agents dashed in either direction as noblewomen, pursing their lips in disapproval of the confusion, stayed out of their way. Tenelka paused and extended her senses into the Force once more. It took only seconds, seconds that dragged on like hours, and then she felt her daughter again, to the left and down. She spun in that direction and ran, allowing the Force to lend her speed, leaving her father far behind. Tenelka ran past a group of courtiers huddled around an open door. Beyond was a uniformed guardswoman, her throat slit, blue eyes open and fixed, blood pooling beside her. A few meters past, in a nook frequented by lovers and conspirators, a musician held the curtain aside to reveal a male courtier lying on the floor, his neck at an unnatural angle. Tenelka felt a ripple in the Force at the next nook beyond. She tossed the curtain aside. No scene of murder met her eyes, but there was a hole in the floor, roughly circular, a meter across, its edges smoking. A security officer running in her wake panted,
Queen Mother, We must precede you.
Ignoring her, Tenel Ka dropped through the hole. She fell 10 meters. Drawing on the force to soften the impact, she landed on the hard, uncarpeted flooring of a service corridor, a gray-walled, cheerless passageway she had never seen before. Up and down the corridor, kitchen workers and food servers. There was no sign of the assassin's passage. But a serving boy, perhaps 16 years, his eyes more alert than most of those around him, jerked a thumb back over his shoulder, then shielded his eyes from the sight of the Queen Mother racing past him. Ahead, around a bend in the corridor, there were more workers circling and staring at the body of a cook. A minute later, Tenel Ka took another 10-meter drop, this time to the roof of a stopped turbolift. She stepped into the access hatch and fell 2 meters to the turbolift floor. The lift doors were open. Beyond was the visitor's hangar. Here, nothing as delicate as chimes indicated a security breach. Shrill alarms screeched. Security and maintenance personnel ran toward her, away from her, some rushing to their alarm situation duties, some just panicking. At least 2 vehicles were active. Not far away, a shuttle painted in white, sporting the Galactic Alliance crest on its sides, had its repulsor lifts going. It was moving, but only to edge ever closer to the stone wall alongside its bay. A security team was in place behind stone and Duracrete columns, all around the shuttle. Some were aiming at the vehicle with blaster rifles, while the leader, speaking into a field comlink strapped to her wrist, was doubtless broadcasting instructions to the pilot. But Tenel Ka could not see a pilot through the shuttle's forward viewports. She reached out toward the vehicle with the force and detected something aboard, but that presence felt inert, nearly lifeless. A diversion. She broadened her perceptions again, looking with increasing desperation for Alana. There, 40 meters past the tableau with the shuttle, another vehicle had its engines running. It, too, was surrounded by a security team holding positions behind columns. Tenel Ka raced past the shuttle, ignoring a salute from a startled-looking guardswoman, and got a good view of the other active vehicle. Tahiri's Stealth X. The coldness in her gut intensified. She did not need to peer into the visor of the pilot's helmet to know who had her daughter. It could only be Jason. She was halfway to the Stealth X when she realized that while its repulsor lifts were being used at full strength, filling the air with what sounded like an animal scream, the starfighter was not moving. Its shields were up too, though no member of the security detail was firing. Another 2 steps, and Tenel Ka could now just see the top of Alana's head. Her daughter was in Jason's lap, webbing holding her to her father. Her head was forward, as though she were asleep or preparing for a crash landing. Tenel Ka felt a flicker in the force from behind her, not from Jason's direction. She stopped and spun, igniting her lightsaber. Tenel Ka's sense of dread of anticipated attack grew. Get back! Her words could not possibly carry to the security officer surrounding the shuttle, but she poured her anxiety and intent into the force, broadcasting her command on an emotional level. Get behind cover! Suiting actions to words, she leapt behind one of the natural stone columns lining the hangar bay and put her back to it. She turned her head to glance toward Jason. He looked straight at her, offering a tight little smile, then held up a comlink. He pressed the button on it. Tenel Ka heard her daughter calling for her, but the Hapen Queen stood in red mud up to her knees, with Alana nowhere in sight. Broken columns tilted at odd angles, and severed arms and legs the size of public transportation speeders protruded from the mud, as far as the horizon, in every direction. Tenel Ka opened her eyes and sat up, looking around wildly for her child. Her head hurt, and her ears rang like someone playing a timpani on a gong. She recognized her surroundings, one of the numberless waiting rooms up at the royal residence level. This one, decorated in subtle variations of purples and off-whites, was adjacent to Alana's playroom. She must have been dreaming. Tenel Ka sat on a morphing divan that had been adjusted to daybed dimensions. Isolder rose from where he'd been sitting on a chair opposite her.
Lie down. You're hurt.
His words were dim, hard to hear over the ringing in her ears. Instead, she stood, wobbling in sudden, passing dizziness.
Where's Alana?
Jason Solo has her. The shuttle blast, a shaped charge, was sufficient to blow a hole in the hangar's exterior wall large enough for his starfighter. He made orbit in his X-wing and escaped.
The coldness in Tenelka's gut spread to envelop her entire body.
Has he communicated? Has he sent terms for her return?
Isolder's expression became even more sour.
He left a message. A data chip handed to the little girl who acted as a double. I'll play it for you.
He rose and moved to a table to activate the monitor upon it. Isolder stepped away from the monitor. Jason Solo popped on the display, somber, dressed Galactic Alliance Guard Colonel's uniform.
Greetings to the ascendant Queen Mother of the Haven Sword. And what? You me into an untenable situation. Being abandoned by ants, abandoned by were whom I once had considerable affection and respect. Murdered. Untenable situation. Being abandoned to my enemies, abandoned by one for whom I once had considerable affection and respect, was like being murdered and surviving. So I'm going to repay the favor. You have a choice to make, like the one you tried to force upon me. You will put all Hapen military forces under my command, with ship senior officers to be supplied by the Galactic Alliance, or your daughter will die.
Jason leaned forward so that his face more completely filled the monitor screen. His eyes were bright, inhuman in their intensity and focus. They even seemed lighter in color than usual.
By doing what you did to me, you changed me into someone capable of doing exactly what I have promised. This threat is not a bluff, and if it takes place, it will be your doing. Something to keep in mind the next time you play the Hapen cultural game of backstabbing and bloodletting.
The screen went dark.
Kashyyyk, Maetal Base. Hangar housing the Millennium Falcon.
Waru set the oversized metal case down on the sabacc table. Han looked down at the case. It looked like the sort wealthy travelers used to transport delicate, expensive clothing. Outfitted with foam inserts, a case like this was also ideal for transporting weapons, and this one was large enough to hold several blaster rifles with folding stocks or a couple of squadrons worth of blaster pistols. Han, opposite the Wookiee, shook his head.
You got me, pal. You sure it's for me?
Waru nodded. Leia looked closely at the case.
I don't feel any sense of menace from it. Did you do a routine scan?
Clean, huh? But no indication who sent it.
Han gave the top seam locks another look. In the shadow cast by the case itself, the broad locking tabs glowed slightly.
That's not too comforting.
It's a scanner.
Jag, leading Jaina and Zek, was walking in from deeper in the hangar, where their X-Wings had their bays.
They read thumbprints.
Huh.
Experimentally, Han placed his thumbs over the tabs, but did not touch them. He glanced at Leia.
I assume you'll give me a push if this starts to blow up.
She affected disinterest. Probably.
Yeah.
He placed his thumbs on the tabs. They beeped, shrill little noises, then gave way under the pressure of his thumbs. He pressed harder, and they clicked into place. Gingerly, Han lifted the case's lid. The case did indeed have foam inserts, but it did not hold firearms. In the bottom was the front piece of a chest plate, shaped in a stylized representation of a male human chest, well-muscled. In the top of the case were two metal gauntlets, nearly elbow length. All three items were made of a dull metal, something like brushed silver or burnished iron. A piece of flimsy was tucked into the gap between one gauntlet and the foam insert that held it. Han pulled it free, unfolded it, and read aloud the words hand-printed on it.
With deepest sympathy.
Leia frowned.
Sympathy for what?
A weight settled on Han's chest. He tried to ignore it.
These are crush gaunts, a Mandalorian weapon. Illegal for generations, plus very hard to make anyway, on account of the Mandalorian veins of Beskar mostly ran out. That's what they're made of.
Jag shook his head, not recognizing the term.
Beskar?
Mandalorian iron. Tough, tough metal. Legend says armor made from the stuff can take a lightsaber hit and survive. Mechanisms in the gauntlet hands allow them to crush whatever they grip. Necks, heads, blaster rifles, just about anything.
Jaina looked puzzled.
So the armor is a Mandalorian breastplate?
Han nodded.
Yeah, the back plate's probably under it.
He lifted the front plate, revealing a matching piece of armor, its surface contoured more like a human back lying there. The front plate was not heavy. It felt more like aluminum than iron.
Uh-huh.
Jaina shook her head.
I still don't get it.
It's a present, Jaina, from Boba Fett.
Han sat heavily in his usual chair.
Get it? Sympathy, for my loss of a son. Something he understands since he lost a daughter. A daughter tortured to death by my son. He's saying, so sad you lost your kid. Here's a little toy you can finish him off with.
Jaina's face became impassive.
Oh, are you going to use it?
No.
So we wasted a lot of money for nothing.
Han nodded. Jag eyed the case.
Han, at the risk of sounding insensitive.
Han snorted.
If you think it's insensitive, whatever it is will probably take the pain off a Hutt's refresher.
Jag gave him a brief apologetic smile.
You're really not going to use this gear?
Han shook his head.
Take it. It's yours.
Coruscant, Galactic Alliance Guard Building.
Alana opened her eyes. In front of her was the corner of the bed she was lying on. A plain bed, its mattress very soft and comfortable, but old-fashioned, not adjusting its shape to her as she moved. Beyond it was a bare brown wall, its simulated wood pattern hard to make out in the dim light of half-shadowed glow rods. She didn't know this place. She rolled over to see the whole room, and there he was, seated in a chair by the bed, tall and handsome, wearing his black uniform, his eyes so bright and intent they almost frightened her. But she shouldn't be frightened of him. He was her mother's friend. She held out her arms.
Jason!
His face twitched a little when she called his name, but he came to her and held her. Alana, you slept a long time.
Where am I?
Her voice was muffled against his shoulder. He drew back to look at her again, and now his eyes were normal. You're on Coruscant.
Where's Mommy?
She's back on Hapes. Alana fidgeted, and, reluctance on his face, Jason released her.
Why is she there and not here?
Bad people came to your palace. They used coma gas, which puts people to sleep. Since you're little, it put you to sleep for a long time. I had just arrived there for a visit. Your mother thought you'd be safer if you came home with me. That way the bad people won't know where you are.
Oh, can I talk to Mommy on the holocom?
Jason shook his head. Not yet. The bad people could trace the transmission. Do you know what that means? Alana nodded.
Like following a trail of breadcrumbs.
Exactly. So we'll just have to stay hidden for a while. But I'm arranging to have all sorts of things brought here for you to play with. Toys and gadgets and musical instruments.
And friends?
Not yet. Soon, I hope. He gave her another hug. I've got to go, but I'll be watching through that holocam. He pointed straight up, but Alana could see nothing on the ceiling there. So you'll always be safe. Just call for me if you need anything.
Coruscant, beneath the Galactic Alliance Government District.
There were five of them. Jedi all, ranging in experience from a teenage girl to a graying veteran who had first seen action as a stormtrooper serving Palpatine's Empire. Valen Horn, son of Corran, breathed a sigh of relief that he was not at the low end of the age ranking. In his late 20s, he was, by a statistical accident that seemed to plague him, often paired with much older Jedi. Here, Master Kyle Katarn was indeed his senior by some 40-odd years. But the Feline male, Thon Mithrick, and the Bothan female, Kalir Hulya, were both his junior by several months. And the human girl leading them, Saha, was youngest of all. All five Jedi wore matte black garments that covered them from neck to toes. The Jedi carried packs containing their lightsabers, robes that could be folded into very compact bundles, other weapons, and climbing equipment. None of which was likely to help them at the moment, as they wriggled their way like worms along a damp, constricting waste fluids pipe.
Don't worry, she'd said. If there's a flood, we'll have a few moments warning. You just whip out your lightsabers and cut a hole in the pipe.
Valen heard a familiar buzzing noise from ahead and stopped to listen. Yes, it was a lightsaber, but not being used in haste. Kalir stopped too. The buzz went on for nearly a minute, then ceased. Kalir finally passed back the news.
Sahar reached a new obstacle, a metal grate. She was using her lightsaber to cut through it.
Moments later, he wriggled out through the newly opened, still warm end of the tube and dropped lightly to a duracrete floor 2 meters down. He stood aside to let Mithrik drop beside him. Valen glanced around. The others had smudges of grease and filth on their faces. Kalir's tan fur was matted and encrusted in places. Mithrik's ponytail had a spherical six-legged bug climbing through it. Valen assumed he himself looked equally unappetizing. Saha, the least filthy of them, glanced around to get her bearings.
We're inside the second security zone, under the plaza approach to the Senate building.
Master Katarn nodded.
Staging from here will be fine, though it would be better if we had several lines of sight and firing positions.
Saha gestured forward and up toward a dark vertical shaft assessed by durasteel rungs inset into the permacrete.
That's the closest one. There will be a sensor at the access hatch, but we can disable it. I can take you laterally to three or four similar spots, each with a view of the front entrance.
Hours after their arrival at their destination, each Jedi was positioned beneath a different plaza-level access cover, except for Saha, who shared Master Katarn's. Valen studied his hands. His palms were bandaged over the scrapes and cuts he'd picked up both in getting to this spot and then from the hours of training Saha had put them through, tracing and retracing routes from their assigned stations to the exit point where Master Katarn and Saha were now situated. Valen hung in a vertical shaft similar to the one Saha had pointed out earlier. Suspended from durasteel access rungs by cables and snap-to climbing hooks, sitting on a broad cloth sling that had been comfortable an hour earlier, he was a bare meter below the exit hatch. In addition to the slick suit and his backpack, he wore a set of optics, not electro-binoculars, but a holocam monitor structured as a set of goggles. Attached to them was a tiny optic cable that ran up and through the locking mechanism of the access hatch, its tiny holocam end protruding through the other side and oriented toward the main Senate building entrance. Just now, it showed little. There was still an hour or more to go until dawn, and there was little pedestrian or speeder traffic at surface level. The holocam cable was not the only one that ran from him. Another ran from the earbud he wore to the wall, to which it was attached by a lump of greenish glue. It ran down the shaft and off to the station Katarn and Saha shared. Comlink transmissions might be detected, especially so close to the Senate building, where security was so high. Exchanges of images or feelings through the Force might be detected by Jason Solo. That left an antiquated but remarkably reliable standby, the intercom. Mithrik's voice came across it now.
Kulir has got her antenna up and out. She's receiving HoloNet news.
Valen snorted. What's new?
Elements of the Third Fleet attacked Commodore. In addition to hammering at military forces, they dropped asteroids on the planet proper. They hit population centers, like city buster bombs.
Valen whistled. Had to be Colonel Solo's orders, not Admiral Nyathal's.
That's the weird thing. Apparently it was neither. The task force commander did it on his own initiative. He's been brought to Coruscant to face charges.
The next voice Valen heard was Kulir's.
The Kaminori are going to retaliate. I mean, beyond just a normal military response, aren't they?
Probably.
That was Master Katarn.
Even if it wasn't because of orders from chiefs of state, the GA just violated conventions of war. How is Admiral Nyathal going to persuade them that it was a rogue commander, that the Kaminori should fight fair? I don't think it's going to happen.
Valen's holocam view, a wrenching 360-degree panorama, showed distant lights inbound, a short stream of them at ground level.
Heads up, Jedi. Looks like a convoy approaching my position.
The convoy, three airspeeders past Valen's position. The first one was a black Galactic Alliance guard vehicle, a small, speedy four-passenger model. The alert lights atop the vehicle were not active. The second was a civilian speeder. The third was a black GAG group carrier. And the one individual whose identity Valen could make out through the second speeder's side viewport set off alarm bells in his mind.
This could be him. It's all GAG and a VIP.
Katarn's voice remained outwardly calm.
Did you see Solo?
No, but there's other bad news. The second vehicle is carrying a YVH combat droid.
The Yuuzhan Vong hunter droids, designed at the height of the Yuuzhan Vong War, were formidable. In a one-on-one match between a Jedi Knight and a YVH droid, the odds were about even. If the Jedi was inexperienced, if the battle dragged on long enough for her to tire, she was likely to be the loser. A dead loser.
Ready yourself?
Katarn continued to sound calm, almost bored.
They're pulling up near my position.
The three vehicles slowed to a simultaneous stop. First, the side slabs of the trooper carrier lifted. Six GAG troopers with blaster rifles stepped out from the benches on each side. Six flanked the center vehicle. The other six moved toward the Senate building and then stopped, arrayed in two lines of three, with 3 meters of space between the lines. The doors of the second vehicle rose, and the first being to emerge was the YVH. The angular droid moved out from the front seat, opened the rear passenger's side door, and extracted a shipping crate from the back seat. At a meter tall and wide, a meter and a half long, black like most GAG gear, the crate was large enough to be unwieldy. The droid pulled it partway out, then lifted it, demonstrating remarkable care and delicacy. Then the rear driver's side door opened, and Jason Solo, his cape fluttering in a light breeze, stepped out. Katarn's voice remained maddeningly calm.
Wait until he's a few meters from the vehicle.
Solo himself waited until the combat droid carried its mystery package around to his side of the speeder. Then, side by side, they walked toward the Senate building entrance.
Go.
Behind him, from all over the nearly deserted plaza, Kytus heard four metal clanks and knew there was trouble. He and YVH-908 spun. He heard a faint exclamation of complaint from inside the crate as Alana was whirled. Then, from out in the darkness, came a succession of poom, poom, poom noises. He ignited his lightsaber. Secure the package! In his peripheral vision, he saw the combat droid whirl again, completing a 360-degree turn, accompanied by another woof from Alana, and then began running toward the doors, its metal heels clanging with each step. A flare ignited high in the air, and Kytus reached upward, sensing through the force, feeling the descent of many tumbling metal cylinders. The sky above lit up as though noon had come more than 6 hours early. Worse, for the brightness surpassed that of high noon. Troopers all around him cried out, threw their arms over their eyes. The visors of their helmets could not darken fast enough to protect their wearers from these dazzle grenades. Kytus cursed. Out in the darkness, the rolling grenades exploded with moist, crump noises. Gas grenades, then. Coma gas? Stun gas? The breeze was from behind him. The gas would not reach him or his troops. Finally, he detected more than just telekinetic pushes. He felt presences, as his enemies drew on force abilities. He felt them rush toward him, caught sight of them as they entered the glow of the lights from the front of the Senate building. Four Jedi. Master Kyle Katarn foremost among them. Katarn ignited his lightsaber as it came to a stop a few meters away.
Care to surrender, Colonel Solo?
Not to a traitor! Kytus looked at the other three as their force-augmented sprints came to an end, leaving them in a semicircle before him. Three Jedi Knights. The younger Horn, the Faleen Mithrik, the Bothan Hulya. He resisted the urge to snort. Separately or collectively, these Jedi Knights were no match for him. Katarn, though, was a threat. Still, the Jedi had only moments before GA reinforcements would arrive. Their attack was already a failure. He sensed Katarn's attack, threw up his blade in a block so well practiced that his muscle memory could have performed it while he slept. With his free hand, he gestured at the Bothan Jedi. She was suddenly airborne, hurtling sideways to slam into the Faleen, knocking them both down. Katarn's blade struck his, rebounded with a snap hiss, and came around from the other side as the Jedi Master executed a lightning-fast spin. Kytus stepped back from it, not engaging the blade. He watched the blade flash harmlessly past him. He stepped forward again into a sidekick, aimed not at Katarn, but at the onrushing Valen Horn. His boot heel caught the Jedi Knight on the point of his chin, knocking Horn backward off his feet. 2 seconds had passed since the attack began. Only Sahaw's head protruded from the pavement hatch as she watched her four companions assault Colonel Solo. In her free hand, she held a patch of black cloth.
It was square, 5 centimeters to a side, and very soft and pliant, despite the fact that its center layer consisted of circuitry embedded in a flexible polymer. One side was covered by a transparent layer of flimsy. With her teeth, she worried an edge of the flimsy free, then pulled the whole layer off, dropping it into the access hole she occupied. The removal of the flimsy exposed a layer of adhesive. With her own force powers, so much less subtle than those of her allies, she sent the cloth patch flying, centimeters above ground level, toward the fight. But she couldn't send it onto her target. Not yet. Master Katarn had been clear about that. She had to wait until things were at their most chaotic, their most distracting. So she guided the patch ever closer to the fight, but waited. Waited. 10 seconds. Kytus rolled out of Katarn's kick to his head, catching a scrape along his cheek, and swung at the master's leg. But Kalir's blade intercepted his before it bit into flesh. His strength battered her weapon away, but she had deflected his blow and spared Katarn an amputation. They're coordinating. Good for them. Bad for me. Kytus heard a siren. An oncoming GAG vehicle. No, two, maybe three. He allowed himself a certain satisfaction at their speed of response. He hadn't expected anything of the sort for another half minute. Then, from the corner of his eye, he saw the first oncoming vehicle, an aging Sentinel-class armored shuttle. It was yellow, with spots of rust. He could not make out its markings without looking at it, but he knew it was not in GAG or Alliance colors. Entering airspace above the plaza, it began a dangerously steep and fast repulsor lift descent. Behind it came 3 GAG airspeeders, one of them firing a top-mounted laser at the shuttle. So they were not responding with brilliant speed to an alarm. They were chasing the Jedi escape vehicle. 15 seconds. Katarn advanced, lightsaber at the ready. Kytus withdrew before him. With part of his awareness, he was keeping track of the 4 inbound vehicles, plotting their trajectories. One of the GAG vehicles was circling ahead and to starboard of the descending shuttle. Its arc, intended to put it toward the bow of the shuttle so it could fire on the cockpit, would bring it near the combatants, just a few meters above them. Kytus reached out a hand, as if intending to hurl Katarn away from him. The master raised his own hand, a deflecting gesture. But Kytus exerted himself against the oncoming GAG speeder, yanking it down and toward all of them. By the time Katarn felt the speeder coming toward him, spinning, its stern a mere 2 meters from his back, it was already too late for him to send a command even to force-augmented nerves and muscles. His face changed with the awareness of danger. Then the speeder's port quarter hit his back, hurling him forward to slam into Kytus. The speeder, continuing its out-of-control motion, slid through the location of the other Jedi, knocking Hulya to the permacrete, causing Horn and Mithrik to leap to safety. Katarn now stood so close to Kytus that every facial feature was visible, every scar and line in his weathered face, every hair on his brow, mustache, and beard. Kytus felt a rush of satisfaction, enjoyment, as Katarn's expression turned from one of surprise to pain. Katarn looked down to see Kytus's lightsaber buried to its hilt in his chest. A noise, something halfway between a groan and a death rattle, emerged from Katarn's lips. Smiling, Kytus yanked his lightsaber free and let the stricken Jedi Master fall face first on the pavement. Sahaw felt all breath leave her body, as though it had been her chest, not Katarn's, that had been pierced. Jacen Solo's exultation washed through the Force and over her like a wave at a beach, almost knocking her free from the rung she held.
No, no, no!
The words rang in her head and were echoed by Mithrik. The Feline Jedi howled them as he charged Solo, his anguish giving him speed and strength as he threw blow after blow at his enemy. Things were at their most chaotic. She focused herself on the distant black patch. It was now only 3 meters from where Colonel Solo disinterestedly blocked Mithrik's attacks. As Colonel Solo twirled, causing his cloak to flare up and away from him, the patch flew to its lower hem and merged with it. Now the 3 Jedi Knights assailed Solo all out, a fight they were doomed to lose. Sahaw could not save them. Her tasks were accomplished. She should leave before Colonel Solo detected her. No, she couldn't. Not while a good man, a teacher, lay dead on the Durakrete in an enemy capital. She reached out to Kyle Katarn. His body jerked, and he slid a meter toward her. She poured more of herself, of her concentration, into her effort. Master Katarn's body began sliding again, continuously now, picking up speed as it scraped its way across the plaza.
One of the GAG troopers fired his blaster at Mithrik. Kalir, hobbling, managed to get her lightsaber blade up and caught the bolt. But it meant that the trooper's vision was returning. Saha saw the Jedi exchanging words. Valen spun away from the engagement with Jason and moved toward the one-sided trooper. That man fired again, and Valen deflected the bolt with his lightsaber, deflected it straight toward Jason. The improvised attack evidently came as a surprise. The bolt grazed Jason's right leg, sending him to his knee. Mithrik redoubled his attack, hammering away at Jason's defense like a toolsmith on a primitive world, battering away at a stubborn harvester droid. Kalir, bent over from distress more than pain, hesitated, then turned and moved at a fast hobble toward the shuttle. Saha pulled one last time, and Master Katarn, shoulders first, slid into her grasp. Katarn's eyes opened. His voice was little more than a wheeze.
Go! You're alive! Explosives package! Give me one. Other one to block exit.
Kydus hadn't felt the blaster bolt coming. His concentration was slipping. And this madman of a Fallen Jedi was starting to beat down his parries. His strength was slipping. He wasn't yet recovered from his duel with Luke. And now, as more of his troopers began firing, Horn began deflecting more bolts at him. Kydus waited until the timing was perfect. Waited until an incoming bolt arrived at the same moment as one of Mithrik's attacks, so he could devote a single maneuver to both. He caught Mithrik's blow toward the hilt of his lightsaber. He caught the bolt near the tip, deflecting it up and straight into Mithrik's chest. Mithrik staggered back, the center of his chest blackened as the smell of burned skin and meat filled the air. Kydus leapt up and executed a single, precise lateral blow. Mithrik's head fell from his shoulders. His body toppled down half a second later. Kydus and Horn spun to face each other. An expression of sadness crossed Horn's face, but his dismay did not distract him. He caught three more blaster bolts with his lightsaber blade without looking at their firers. Kydus gestured toward his troopers, signaling them to cease fire. They did. Now the only ranged fire to be heard came from the speeders, still chewing the shuttle to pieces. Kydus flexed his injured leg experimentally and decided it was not too bad. It would take his weight and allow him some footwork. He gestured toward Horn. You going to try this alone? Horn shook his head. Kydus smiled. You're a fraction of the man your father is. Funny, that's what I was going to say to you. Horn seemed to blur as he dashed toward the shuttle, his sprinting speed augmented by the Force. Don't be an idiot. That thing will never take off again. Kydus left off his harangue as Horn ran up the side ramp where the Bothan had disappeared moments before. No matter. The shuttle would not take off. Horn or Hulya or both would be captured. And after a lengthy enough interrogation, Kydus would know where Luke and the Jedi were now hiding.
Sanctuary Moon of Endor, Jedi Outpost.
The thorns dug deeper into Ben's cheek, pressing against him in the fevered way the creations of the Yuuzhan Vong had when inflicting pain, and he could feel them injecting their venom. His cheek swelled and kept swelling. He could feel the skin grow taut, the tissues beneath it beginning to rip, his nerves screaming. And so he knew it was a dream. He didn't wake up immediately, but the dream ended there, with his realization. A moment later, he opened his eyes. His room had once been a walk-in wardrobe belonging to the commander of this outpost, and as